Do you want one central power to know everything about you? Or would you rather be in charge of your own information?
Hello, and welcome to Exploring Digital Spheres. In today's episode, we talk about smart citizens. We've all got smart products and are connected to the cloud, but that doesn't necessarily make us live in a smart society. Christian Grauvogel interviews Marleen Sticker on the concept of digital participation, connectivity, and disruptive new ideas. They talk about the Fairphone, Fab Labs, and challenging digital business models. Here's their conversation.
Welcome to today's episode of Exploring Digital Spheres. My name is Christian Grauvogel, and I'm here today with Marleen Sticker, founder of VAR Society, an Amsterdam-based interdisciplinary media lab and research institute. Welcome, Marleen.
Thank you.
So I actually wanted to talk today with you about digital cities and smart citizen, but I found out that beside all your work in this field, you invented the Fairphone. So I'm really curious, how did this happen and how is this connected to your work in the digital city?
Well, I think I didn't really invent it, the Fairphone. It was a research project in De Waag, in our organization. Bas van Abel was was head of our creative team and was very much involved in open design and Fab Labs and maker culture. And I think it started by opening up a mobile phone, trying to figure out what's in it. And then we realized that there were a lot of problems with what's inside of those gadgets and mobile phones. A lot of conflict minerals, child labor. You can't really repair. If you open a mobile phone, it's almost immediately kaput. So the idea started for can we change how a mobile phone is being produced? And this was also in the context of a project with people were worried about the conflict minerals in the Congo. So Bas and a team of De Waag went to the Congo to see who was working in the mines to get coltan, for example, which is one of the minerals that you need to make tiny gadgets and mobile phones. And from there it started as an idea. And then we realized we should present it as let's make our own phone, as we do with everything. We have this maker culture in De Waag, hacker culture in De Waag. So we don't take the products and the world for what it is. We want to open it. We want to open the black box. So I think that's why Fairphone is totally in sync with the values and the ideas of De Waag. But from there, it's spun off, and now it's a separate company, 60, 70 people, quite successful, successfully both making a phone, a smartphone, but also still very much in the research mode to figure out what is the chain of production of this kind of technologies and still in a mode of creating open technologies.
So, to understand a bit better what you're working on, with the VAR, you're promoting smart citizen or the term of smart citizens, and you want to educate and empower citizens also in sense of technology, as you explained with the smartphone, with the Fairphone. So what do you exactly mean by the term smart citizens and what are you actually doing to empower citizens in a digital age?
Well, smart citizens, you can see it from two sides. It's both coming from citizen science, from maker culture, from opening up the black box, technology literacy. So citizens that are smart can also really participate in a democracy and have the ability and the knowledge to be an active a partner in it. But it's also, of course, a reaction to the whole theme and frame of the smart city, where the city is smart and the citizens are dumb, or a lot of the smart city technologies tells us that the technology itself can run the city, just put some sensors somewhere, do some artificial intelligence, some deep learning, and all the problems will vanish. And so just trust the technology. And I think for the WAG, we love technology, but we understand that technology is not neutral. So it's really depending on who is creating the technology. Technology is not neutral in the sense that there are instructions in it. If you use data, this is not objective. Every data set is an interpretation of the reality. So it means something about who is defining where we're optimizing for. So for us, smart citizens is sort of a reaction to the smart city, but it's also in itself a program, a very positive program in bringing these technologies into the hands of social innovation and empowerment of individual.
So you're actually, in the WAG society, training citizens to understand technology in a different way and to understand the processes behind, or how are you actually doing this?
Yeah, so the WAG is an institute with around 60 people on staff and another 100 on projects. So we can do a lot of projects, of course, at the same time. So we do research, we do public events, and we also have a regular program on citizen science, where we work together with citizens on how to measure water quality, air quality. So these projects are always together with people in the city, sometimes in the Netherlands, sometimes abroad. We do this also a lot in European collaboration. And yes, these are sessions there. Make Health, for example, is a program where we bring designers, citizens, people with issues because the wheelchair doesn't do what they want that the wheelchair should do. So to help them to solve their own problems together with designers and some hackers or other people with engineering skills. And it's a lot about bringing people together. And we don't believe that anybody in itself, in her or his own right, can understand everything. That also counts for civil servants or even engineers or people from science. You need each other to understand the next steps. It's all very hybrid, very interdisciplinary. So on every average Thursday, we have an open day in the afternoon. People come in, use the Fab Lab. We have a big Fab Lab at the WAG. We also have a big biotech lab at the WAG and a textile lab. So we have all the equipment for people to use. And next to that, we also do training sessions for teachers and for others that are in their profession, librarians, for example. We help the libraries in Amsterdam to become makerspaces. So we also teach the teachers and teach the librarians to become more maker-oriented.
So yesterday we had an event at the HIC where you said not everybody should be able to code, but everybody should be able to understand what's behind it. And also regarding your approach of smart citizens, you're trying to promote that people actually understand that. But isn't that also quite a big task to ask from citizens to actually understand codes? People who have never experienced coding before, and to ask from them to actually understand the technology to be able to participate in a democracy, isn't that also like shifting a bit the responsibility to the citizens and asking quite a lot from them? Because that's nothing which I think we should take for granted. You can't expect people to just sit there in the afternoon or in the spare time and try to figure out how coding works.
Well, I think if it's about what we teach in schools, I think I'm not so much for that everybody has to learn code or to code or programming, but I would love to see that we bring arts and technology together and more purpose-driven questions about environment and about how to understand your own environment. And so this is more digital tinkering or creative tinkering, which is more maker culture. So I would love to see people have more ability to repair their own stuff and be less consumer and more producer, co-producer. But I totally agree with you that it won't be that every citizen will be able to understand the black box or what's inside or behind the technologies. So this is only just one of the measures that we need to do to educate and to open up the ability for people to learn and to participate. But we also need regulation. If you think about our food system, people, when they go into the supermarket, they don't have to check themselves if there's dioxin in the chicken, because we have all kind of regulations for this. So that should be the same for all the apps that we download. It should be totally normal that the parties that are putting these apps in the app store can't take your data away. And now this is not regulated good enough. So we need really fierce regulation, so that even very, very, so not only the happy few has the ability to understand and choose for an alternative, but that it's just normal that this kind of technology apps and gadgets, that they don't surveil us. It's really weird. I mean, they're now selling these smart shoes. Actually, they're being hacked. So and then you can't walk anymore. So you buy stuff. It's so strange. People buy the stuff to and then this technology turns against you. It's a very strange concept. So we have to be protected to this kind of technology.
So you would suggest that, analog to the regulations we have in analog world, in like if you look at consumer rights, that we somehow also adapt them in the digital sphere and have like the consumer rights we have in the analog world also implement that in
course,
the digital sphere.
And at the moment it's quite a strange time because on one hand we have the GDPR, which is the privacy law coming from Europe, which has to be implemented in every nation state, and that's definitely a game changer. But we also have Article 13 now, which is protecting the rights of publishers, which is against consumer rights. So from Europe, they're very. It's a very strange situation that also PSD2, which says that banks need have to share our bank information with third parties, based on our consent, but we know how we give our consent. Like, you give me a little bit discount, oh, you have my consent. So the question is, if people give consent to third parties to do something with their data, is this real? Can we ask people to make that decision? So yes, we need to regulate it, but it will take us a lot of time, a lot of years to get it right. This is not an easy thing. There are so many different lobbies on European privacy legislation, but also on the rights of publishers, the telecom rights. So it will 25 years we took it for granted. We approached the internet as a market, and the market players would do right. And of course, it's not right. It's far from right. So it will take us at least 25 years. I hope faster, 5 years, to get back to a more commons-based internet, which public values and where not the market is in charge.
So now you mentioned also data governance as an important aspect. And the question: who actually governs the data which is produced on a daily basis? That's something you're also working on with a Decode project, European-funded project, also in collaboration, amongst others, with the city of Barcelona. And what is happening in that project, as far as I know, or as far as I understood, is also that trying to develop more communal alternatives to existing platforms. And that's something also you promote yesterday in your talk, that we need also communal owned platforms beside the ones which already exist to actually have an alternative we can promote to citizens. But isn't that the paradox of platforms, that if there's one existing platform running, that it's not really that easy and possible to just set up your own thing and say, okay, well, we have another alternative, really good data governance model on this platform, which is really citizen-centered. Now, please move all to this alternative, which is communal or state-owned. But that actually, if there's one big player in the platform, that the people stay on it. Like, there have been examples with Airbnb and co, where people try to set up something else. I think that's also something you're doing with the Bach. And then you see that it's really difficult to move the people there, even if they see the direct benefit. Like, how do you think we could tackle that question and how we could deal with that problem?
Yeah, I've started the Facebook Liberation Army with Geert Lovink and some others in 2014. And we throw this party, the Facebook farewell party. And so people showed up, but a lot of people were very hesitant because they didn't know how to leave Facebook because it's their own, well, propaganda machine, for example, or they have all their relationships there, or they have all their family ties there. So it's quite difficult for people to leave a social platform when they invested so much time in it. And on the same time, people start to feel very unease with these platforms. And people are much more open to alternatives than before. So when I was, so to me, the difference between 2014 with the starting point of the Facebook Liberation Army and then 2018, the GDPR, but also national television, a show that from Lubach, a very popular television host, who altogether said, we are going to leave Facebook altogether with 300,000 people. I think there is a big change. I think the and of course the first have to leave, and then the others will follow as always. And we have seen this in the past as well. We see that young people don't go to Facebook at the moment. They're on Instagram. That's another problem. That's the same problem, of course. I do see that it's problematic to get people to another platform. On the other hand, we also have to make it very easy. And at the moment, it's not that easy. So if you ask for alternative to Facebook or Instagram, it's difficult. I mean, there's not a real good alternative. If you think about an alternative to Google search, I can say DuckDuckGo, Startpage. So there are many of them already. If you ask people alternative to Google Mail or Gmail, I can say ProtonMail. So for a lot of the now existing technologies, there are alternatives. Only for social media, it's more difficult. And I think we're very close to a new generation of social media. And they will be very attractive and well-designed. And they will have all the public values that we want to have in it, which means attribute-based identity, which means distributed data storage. There are a lot of people also in Germany working on this. The project DAT project is a protocol which we need for a new architecture for social media, but also a person like Tim Berners-Lee with Solid. Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the web, is working on something which is more decentralized as a framework. So yeah, I think we are getting closer to it. But so we need really good alternatives before people will move to something else.
Coming back to the question of data governance a bit there in that field, so alternatives also would request a different model of data governance. And then also regarding your process of empowerment, I think people to also take the step of changing, people need to understand how data governance work and what's actually happening with the own data. But isn't that such a, as you explained before, isn't that such a complex theme to understand and to get into it and understand the process behind, that it's really difficult to explain that and break it down to the people on a daily basis? So like, how can you promote empowerment by breaking down complex technological processes into a daily base?
I think sometimes it's being very being mystified. It's very complex and you can't really understand it. You need to study ICT or informatics or AI. I think part of the narrative around technology is that it's being mystified. And so demystifying is also a very important aspect of our work, which says, and you can simplify it. So you can simplify it, you make it more clear what are the rules, and you have to bring it back to the stories. Do you want one central power to know everything about you, or would you rather be in charge of your own information? People now think it's inherent of the internet that you lose your privacy, But it's not. It's based on the business models of these companies. So if we change that, and we show that it's possible to have companies that don't make their business by profiling you, by being paid to mislead you and to manipulate you, then it's much easier. So you don't, not everybody has to understand in the technological aspects of it, but it's also about what kind of company is this? What is their purpose? Why are they there? What are they doing? So I think we get back to the normal storyline that we know, like who is in charge? Where is the power? Where is there any democratic, accountability to what the company is doing? And at the moment, people experience enough of what's happening. All these revelations about Cambridge Analytica and all the other stuff, what's happening at the moment. I think there's enough journalists working on these cases to make it clear what is the values behind the big tech companies at the moment. And I mentioned the book of Shoshana Zuboff, the Rise of Surveillance Capitalism. Also more like scholars and researchers and professors are really doing good research on making it visible. And again, I think everybody who has there's a group of people that have a moral obligation to make the right choices. These are politicians. These are people in policy making for healthcare organizations, educational organizations. They have to make the moral decisions. With whom are they going to work together? Are you expecting your students to work with Gmail and Google Mail, or Gmail and Google? Or will you choose for alternatives? Are you paying Facebook for your advertisement, or are you going to stop to do that? These are decisions. So I'm not saying that every single citizen should know about it, but I think there are some obligations to people that make policies, and they have to make the right choices there.
So what would be your future vision, your optimist vision for a digital city? So where do you see the potential of technology on top of the societal base, which is needed, as I understood you, but where do you see the potential? Where could this lead as a, let's say, future imaginary? Where do you think the technology could bring us in a positive way in the digital city? Like, what is really needed?
Well, I think that my original enthusiasm for the internet back in 92, 93, when I started to use it for some activities, is that it can enable and empower people to collaborate, to work together over time and over space. And we can share solutions and make it available to other people. We can create a common knowledge, common tools. So I think the commons potential of the internet still is the thing that drives me and makes me happy. And I do see how it enables people to educate themselves or to find new relationships or to build new companies or organizations. The energy transition, as we is since we have distributed technology, which on the background, the internet isn't distributed architecture, where you can add a node to the network and then you have all the access. So it is decentralized, which is very important and very disruptive in potential. So I think this potential is still there. It's also still working. So energy transition is possible as a distributed process because we have the tools. The whole concept of the power of the factories and the power of 3D printing and personal fabrication, these are also two ways to think about how we develop the products. So again, distributed knowledge, open design can help also to become closer to our own, to be less consumer, more producer. So yeah, I do believe there's still a lot to gain from distributed open technologies, and but we really have to fight and be very aware of the dangers that lies into the more centralized powers that are in the platforms at the moment.
So still a lot of work ahead. Good luck with that. I'm excited what's going to be next. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That were Christian Grauvogel and Marleen Sticker. If you want to know more about the Smart Citizen, have a look at the show notes. And as always, for more information on research done at The Hague, visit hiig.de. This was Exploring Digital Spheres. Catch you on the flip side.